Good afternoon. My name is Paul Kushner. I'm the chair of the Physics Department Colloquium Committee this year. And I'd just like to start by thanking Judy Fotherby, who's the colloquium coordinator, and Don Teo, who's our technical assistant, for their help. The colloquium series is funded by the department and features a wide range of speakers speaking on many topics that reflect the very diverse interests of the research groups here. And it also serves to highlight the connections between physics and other disciplines across the university. And so in the setting of these broader connections, it's my pleasure to introduce Peter Gallison, who is a university professor at Harvard. He holds two doctoral degrees, one in theoretical high energy physics, which he did with Howard Gyorgy and Shelley Glashow, and another in the history of science, which he completed with Gerald Holton and Ed Purcell. So all this at Harvard. He's a very active and influential scholar who's worked hard to place modern physicists like Poincaré and Einstein and others back, in his words, into the concrete situations that they were involved in. And what this results are some very interesting books, in particular a popular book, Einstein's Clocks, Poincaré's Maps, that provide insight into why the scientists made the choices they did and the kind of research problems they encountered. If there's anybody standing, you have to go to the overflow room. Anybody in the aisles? Okay, no, we need to send you over. All right, thank you. All right, so I just wanted to mention that Peter's influence here at the university is actually pretty concrete. He has three former students who are in faculty in philosophy or at the IHPST, and some of them are here in the audience, and I'm pleased to welcome them. So just one final note before letting Peter start. He was actually invited to be one of our Welsh lecturers last year. For those of you outside the department, Welsh lectures are distinguished lecture series that we hold at the end of the year. Unfortunately, Peter was not able to come. He would have been the first history of science person to do that. So we can think of this as, it's the start of the colloquium series, but we can also think of this as a kind of informal Welsh lecture. And for that, we're very pleased to have him here and look forward to hearing about the assassin of relativity. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for coming. I know over the last year, many of you will have heard and read an enormous amount about Albert Einstein. And today what I'd like to do is to tell you a different sort of story, one in which the physics of Einstein, the philosophical concerns of the time, and the politics crossed in a rather unusual way, as Einstein and one of his closest friends and someone with whom he spoke a great deal during the crucial younger years in his career, took a very different path and marked off with Einstein two different approaches to how to handle the coming 20th century. One of the two figures I'll be speaking about, of course, is Einstein, then unknown, around 1900 to 1910, who became, of course, the best-known figure of the 20th century. The other was one of his closest friends, a fellow student, housemate, physicist, and philosopher, who shared so much with young Einstein, but took a different and radically different path. Friedrich Adler, his name, fought and followed his father, Victor Adler, who was head of the Austrian Workers' Party. Let me just, this is Adler's parents. Victor Adler was one of the most important figures within the political ranks of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And this is young Adler. When his father pushed him, that is to say, when Victor Adler pushed young Friedrich to study something practical like engineering, young Adler chose the abstractions of physics and epistemology. When his father argued for more professorial ambition, Fritz plunged into leftist politics, a dynamic that may not have surprised Victor Adler, not only as head of the Socialist Party, but as a psychiatrist. In fact, he was well enough known that Sigmund Freud dreamed of Victor Adler and reported on his dream, in which Victor Adler castigated him for some of his biocentric views, as he reported in the early pages of The Interpretation of Dreams. During his theory years, Friedrich Adler had been a fellow student with Albert Einstein at the Eidgenössische Technische Hochschule in Zurich. They had the same thesis advisor, Alfred Kleiner, and both battled furiously with him over just about everything from physics to the future of their careers. In 1908, both Einstein and Adler applied for a job there that had just come open. Adler from the position of a Privatdozent, an assistant professor, at the University of Zurich. Einstein is a clerk from the Baron Patent Office. Friedrich Adler wrote his father on the 19th of June, 1908, that his competition, and I quote, is a man named Einstein who studied at the same time as I did. We even heard a few lectures together. Our development is seemingly parallel. He married a student at about the same time as I, and also has children. But no one supported him, and for a time he half-starved. As a student, Einstein was treated contemptuously by the professors. The library was often closed to him, etc. He had no understanding of how to get along with the important people. Finally, he found a position in the patent office in Bern, and throughout the period, that is to say from 1902 up through the time he's writing this letter, which is 1908, he has been continuing his theoretical work in spite of all distractions. Today he is in the school of Boltzmann, and one of the most distinguished and recognized. And this school, not that of Mach, is the mode today. Ludwig Boltzmann's statistical mechanics, not Ernst Mach's sense data positivism, may have been the mode. It was definitely not the fashion that Adler wore. Mach did these beautiful experiments on psychophysiology, on many aspects of physics, including his famous study of a bullet moving through the air, where he was able to track the distortions of the air and the shock wave, even at supersonic speeds. His loyalties were to Mach on physics, epistemological, and political grounds. But Einstein's epistemic physics classification with Boltzmann did not sway Adler for a moment from backing Einstein for the position he himself, that is to say Adler, was pursuing. To the Board of Education in 1908, Fritz wrote, "If it is possible to obtain a man like Einstein for our university, it would be absurd to appoint me." "I must quite frankly say that my ability as a research physicist does not bear even the slightest comparison to Einstein's. Such an opportunity to obtain a man who can benefit us so much by raising the general level of the university should not be lost because of political sympathies." There were socialists on the Board of Education, and they were quite sympathetic to Adler and his political direction. The Einsteins and the Adlers took up residence in the same building, 12 Musonstrasse, which is right in back of, if you know Zurich at all, in back of the ETH and the University of Zurich, which are across the street from each other. This is the University of Zurich, this is the ETH, and this is where they lived, right up behind it. In this building, on this side. Both Einstein and Adler had married Slavs, both had young children. From that building, Adler wrote his father, "We are in very good terms with the Einsteins, who live above us, and, as it happens, we are closer to them than to any of the other academics. They run a bohemian household like ours. Their young children played together, and the two physicists retreated to the attic, up there on the right, for a discussion. The more I talked to Einstein," Friedrich Adler added, "the more I realized that my favorable opinion of him was justified. We find ourselves in agreement on questions which the majority of other physicists would not even understand." They were talking about the nature of space and time and what absolute space and absolute time might signify. Such questions no doubt included a shared Machian disdain for any of these absolutist metaphysical notions like absolute time or space. Adler's high estimation of Einstein was reciprocated. By the end of 1910, most everyone knew that Einstein was about to be offered a professorship at the German University at Prague. "One can now read in the professional journals about my appointment at Prague," said Einstein, "but I have not yet received any communication. If it really comes, then I wish Friedrich Adler would become my successor." Adler had written extensively on Mach's phenomenological approach to physics, and written some more technical papers too, ones that Einstein respected, on thermodynamics, bashing Ostwald's attempts to reduce all physics to the study of energy and its transformations. But Adler's succession to Einstein was not to be. With some reluctance, weighted down by financial concerns, Friedrich Adler abandoned epistemology and physics for party work in Zurich. Essentially, giving up the job, pushing Einstein for that job, had cost him his career. And after 1911, back in Vienna, Victor's unsuccessful struggles to persuade him to continue with his work in theoretical physics notwithstanding, Einstein and Adler remained in contact. In fact, in 1911, Friedrich brought Einstein to his parents' residence in Vienna, where they spent a memorable evening in intense discussion. In the summer of 1914, Leon Trotsky, then in exile in Vienna, visited the Socialist Workers' Party to meet with the Adlers, father and son, and recorded this. This is Adler again. "In the secretariat, I came across Friedrich Adler, or Dr. Fritz, as he's called in top party circles. Thin, good height, slightly stooping, with a fine brow over which his curly, shining hair fell down, and with the imprint of a perpetual thoughtfulness on his face, Fritz stood apart as one amongst the quite numerous Vienna party intellectuals so ready for wise cracks and cheap anecdotes. He spent a year and a half in Zurich as assistant professor of physics and as editor of the local party newspaper, Volksrecht, People's Right." Trotsky continued, "The young Adler, with his inimitable revolutionary temperament, disdained the old system his father ran. But Fritz Adler's real criticism, according to Trotsky, his distrust and his hate, were directed at the Habsburg regime. During their last meeting on the 3rd of August, 1914, Friedrich Adler showed Trotsky the government's appeal to the population. 'Hunt the suspicious foreigners,' it said." Trotsky again, "It was with concentrated abhorrence that he, young Adler, spoke of the rising orgy of nationalism and chauvinism, but his outward restraint merely masked his profound moral shock." Then Victor Adler stepped into the secretariat, suggesting that Trotsky immediately accompany him to the chief of the political police. The fact that the head of the Socialist Party could take Trotsky to the head of the political police indicates how confident he was of his position within Viennese society. To find out what the government intended to do with the Russian exiles. In the car, Trotsky gestured to the festive reaction to be seen out the windows towards the beginning of the war. Victor responded, "All the unbalanced and all the insane are coming out on the streets. This is their day. War throws open the field to every instinct and every type of lunacy." Psychiatrist Adler, according to Trotsky, viewed politics, especially as he often put it, Austrian politics, as a form of psychopathology. Adler apparently had enough clout with the government to get immediate audience with police chief Hayek, who told the leftist duo that leaving town would be an excellent idea. "For tomorrow?" Trotsky asked. "No, rather today," Hayek responded. "Right now." 3 hours and 10 minutes later, the Adlers had Trotsky and family on a train for Switzerland. Furious as he was at the slaughter of war, Einstein in late 1915 was immersed in the hardest work of his life, modifying and extending the equations of general relativity. In the third week of November 1915, he realized that the theory correctly described the precession of the perihelion of Mercury. Overcome with emotion, he told a collaborator he had the feeling that something inside him had actually snapped. Friedrich Adler's passionate opposition to the war was directed elsewhere. At lunch on 21 October 1916, Einstein's parallel life friend, as Adler called him, took his Browning pistol, walked up to Count Sturg, the Prime Minister of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, who was dining at the prestigious Meisselin Schaden Hotel, and put 3 bullets through the politician's head. This is Sturg. This is the room where the assassination took place. This is a reconstruction of the assassination on the front page of the newspaper the next day. And here's the police blotter report of the event, including a diagram of the blood. Immediately arrested, Adler was matter of fact, sachlich, in his responses to the authorities' questions. In May 1917, the Viennese authorities hauled Adler before an exceptional court in Vienna. A cause célèbre, the courtroom was packed, the windows thrown open, and hundreds hung on every word. In his defense, Adler reduced a wide range of offenses by Sturg, fastening on 2. Under the former leader's bureaucratic and brutal rule, no one, Adler argued, knew who really ruled Austria. Go to a minister and you'd be told it wasn't his department. You had to see Sturg. Go to Sturg, you'd be sent to the military. Sturg, Adler contended, was not a man of the politics of what the Austrians call in slang Fortwursteln, kind of get along, go along. He was a man who, with clear intent and conscience, wanted to transform Austria into an absolutist state, and who, with a clear course and steady hand, steered for that goal. He was an opponent, according to Adler, whom one had to notice and with whom one had to battle relentlessly. Second, it was Sturg who had dissolved Parliament, Sturg who had wrecked the progressive goal towards democracy that most civilized countries had already begun to follow, Sturg who had therefore stood as a dead point, ein Totepunkt, that had to be bypassed if Austrian history was to progress. In addition, Sturg had shut down many of the newspapers and began massive censorship of those that remained open. To save his son's life, Victor Adler pleaded for the court to find Friedrich Adler insane. He invoked Friedrich's past history, where his drive to work had surpassed all reason. He gestured to mental illness found on so many branches of the family tree. And Victor hired a superb psychiatric defense team to demonstrate the incompetence of his son as the court deliberated whether he should hang. Aiding the defense was a testimonial from the Physical Society of Zurich introduced at the trial and duly recorded in the transcript, along with another by Professor Heinrich Zanger. Adler's lawyer, Dr. Gustav Hauptner, insisted on the spontaneous nature of these glowing reports, both of which spoke to Adler's scientific, philosophical, and personal qualities. Hauptner, I don't need to say that I did not ask for this testimonial. It was a fully spontaneous intervention, and that he hadn't known until that very day that the scientific society or Professor Zanger would deliver such rousing defenses. Spontaneous? Not quite. Barely 48 hours after receiving Friedrich Adler's communication, Albert Einstein had intervened. Dear Zanger, Einstein had written, the day before yesterday I got a scientific letter from my old friend Fritz Adler. You surely know what the man has perpetrated. I know you never thought particularly highly of him because of his mawkish scientific orientation, but as a person he is an exceptional fellow and extraordinarily selfless, which has in fact gotten him into this stew. My compassion for him has grown so strong that I really would like to do something for him. Behind Zanger's spontaneity stood Einstein. In April 1917, Einstein also wrote Adler directly in prison. I hope you have received my package. I now have an unusual request. When your affair is deliberated in court, I would like to be summoned there as a witness. You should apply for this. Do not think this senseless, for not only the circumstances directly connected to the event are clarified through witness accounts, but statements are also brought forward that shed light on the character of the perpetrator. How much I would like to discuss the relativity problem with you. As we'll see in a moment, that discussion was already in train, but politics weighed heavily on Einstein too. Remember, this is in the middle of World War I. The war, the physics of simultaneity, politics, all fused even among Einstein's friends, including the scientist, philosopher, industrialist Walter Rathenau, former head of the War Provisions Board and author of a book called Towards a Criticism of Time, or The Times. Modifying Einstein's thought experimental description of the coordination of clocks in which one exchanged light signals and uses that to sync the clocks, Rathenau dropped a letter to Einstein just before Adler's trial. Your illustration of the two flashes of lightning, he said, and the train really gripped me here. Incidentally, I turned it into two dynamite explosions and a czar train. What startles the czar twice is only a single matter for the assassin. This is Walter Rathenau, who's the head of the War Provisions Board. Einstein so feared Adler's execution that he wrote the emperor, setting aside the most productive and active work of his life on a general relativistic cosmology. Here's the sheet he was working on, his cosmological calculations, and on the back is this letter to the emperor. His Majesty, under the pressure of an unavoidable duty, I take the liberty of communicating a plea to your Majesty. The political murder of which Fritz Adler is guilty shook the well-being of every rightly sensitive person in the deepest way. With not a single word will I prettify this gruesome act. With regard to the psychological situation of the perpetrator, however, it seems to me to have to do with a tragic accident rather than a crime. Few can have known Herrn Adler so well as me. I have known Herrn Adler since we were studying physics together 20 years ago in Zurich. He was for several years still my closest colleague as an assistant professor in physics at Zurich. We also were at that time housemates. In those years, I took Adler to be a man of the purest character, of an almost unparalleled selflessness. Few people have shown themselves to me to be so unqualifiedly reliable and honest as he. Few have, in such measure, overcome their own desires and devoted their strength to other than personal things. Under these circumstances, I feel an unavoidable duty if I herewith submit to your Majesty from the bottom of my heart a plea for you to invoke the law of clemency in the event that Adler is sentenced to death. A valuable life could therefore be preserved. On the 18th and 19th of May, 1917, Sturd's assassin broke his public silence. Hauled before the Ausnahmegericht, the special court, as Einstein feared, Adler faced hanging. A scene from the court. Debate raged. Victor Adler's hope for an insanity ruling had its best chance through the psychiatric report. But the commission found nothing crazy in the motivation of Adler's act. Indeed, as they saw it, Adler's act, from the standpoint of morality, must, and I'm quoting, be considered as in some ways in contradiction to his character, as has been demonstrated up to the present. One must say that his life has been up to now idealistic, and all his efforts have been in that direction. He is, however, a fanatic, far from the normal type. The fanatic and mentally ill might be branches from the same trunk, the commission allowed. They conceded, too, that Adler was hereditarily a psychopathological person who suffered depressions and shallow manic states. But the experts ruled that the act of which Adler was accused did not take place under such psychopathological conditions. Instead, it must be understood as the response of Adler's personality to given outward circumstances. These experts said, Adler may be psychopathological, but he was responsible for what he had done. Against his own survival interest, but in favor of his political intentions, Adler insisted he agreed he was fully responsible for his act as an expression of a political conviction. Already before the attack, he said, I knew full well that people would say at first that I committed this act as an incompetent. I was prepared, I had to be prepared, that the press, above all, would be under influence by the regime. Battling for Friedrich Adler's sanity and fate were two oddly paired sides. On the side of insanity sat Victor Adler, who, as father and psychiatrist, was desperately trying to make the case for his son's hereditarily induced loss of equilibrium, joined by the vicious right-wing press seeking to strip the assassination of any political import. Meanwhile, in February of 1917, Trotsky recalled in writing Victor Adler's biting words about the psychopathology of Austrian politics. How far, Trotsky wrote, Victor was at that moment from the thought that his own son would carry out a political assassination. I mention this because after Fritz Adler's act of assassination, the Austrian yellow press attempted to present the self-sacrificing revolutionary as unbalanced, even insane, from the standpoint of their own base sanity, that is. But the judicial medicine of the Habsburgs was forced to capitulate before the courageous tenacity of the terrorist. With what cold contempt Fritz would have treated the retorts of the eunuchs of social patriotism, that is, like Adler's father, who, like in each of the European countries, there was a social patriot movement that supported the government's war efforts but wanted socialism also, and they were opposed by people like Trotsky and Adler, who were for an international socialism. With what contempt Fritz would have treated the retorts of the eunuchs of social patriotism if their voices had reached him in prison. That's Trotsky. This pro-sanity alliance of the state, the medical psychiatric panel, Trotsky, and Friedrich Adler himself left bad odds for the defense, counting on a psychiatric exemption to the death penalty. But before continuing, we need to step back, because from prison, as he awaited trial, Adler went on the attack. Einstein's final synoptic paper of the general theory of relativity was finished in March 1916, and Einstein himself was deeply affected by politics all this while. During the war, Einstein had faced off against most of his professional colleagues. Back in October 1914, dozens of luminaries, including the biologist Ernst Haeckel and the discoverer of X-rays, Wilhelm Röntgen, had signed a manifesto to the civilized world berating critics of the German military and defending German militarism in general and war actions in particular. Einstein, with two colleagues, responded in 1915 with a minority manifesto of their own, lobbying for a League of Europeans and an end to the catastrophic fighting. To the French author Romain Rolland, Einstein lamented the idiocy of militant nationalism that was tearing apart three centuries of European cultural achievement. Once, Einstein remarked that he felt roughly the same emotional bond to the nation-state as he did to his life insurance company. Even scholars, he sadly remarked, had thrown their lot in with the insanity of nationalism. Einstein's wartime interventions were frequent, public, and private. When he heard of the assassination, he acted. Einstein wrote to Katya, Adler's wife, on 20 February 1917, 4 months after the shooting, three before the trial. Your misfortune and that of your husband, who I have always admired, touched my heart deeply like little else that I have witnessed in this hard world. He is one of the most splendid and purest men I have ever known. I cannot judge his deed, since I cannot assess the motive behind it. I do not believe him capable of rash acts. He is much too conscientious for that. If there is something you think I can do for you, think of me and write me. About the same time, in mid-February, Adler wrote Katya and his parents from prison about Einstein. Adler, I am suddenly a physicist again. I have made a discovery that one would not be overestimating if one described it as the greatest possible in the current state of physics. Just so you understand, he's on death row, right? I awoke Saturday with the solution to a small problem which has bothered me for more than a year, namely the Foucault pendulum problem. In the course of working through the consequences of my little insight, I have arrived at a generalization of the Newtonian principles, an elementary law which up till now has simply been overlooked. It would, Adler believed, give clarity to all questions of mechanics and thermodynamics. A few days later, he wrote to say his trial had been postponed until after Easter 1917, a good thing, he reported, since he was very satisfactorily plunged into theoretical physics. It has unexpectedly come to pass that I have found a decisive criterion in relativity theory that rules against Mach and Einstein and four Lorentz. Okay, so Einstein is working to save his life. And he's just about to launch a major attack on the theory of relativity. Okay. It puts everything in a new light, or as he put it in his letter to his parents, what Mach searched for, I have found. Like all great discoveries, it was simple and full of consequences. Friedrich Adler's discovery opened for him a new campaign. For Victor Adler, it launched a second front in which he too could fight to have his son declared insane. The insanity of opposing Albert Einstein. Adler the elder shot copies of his son's new manuscript to Einstein, Philipp Frank, the philosopher physicist, and others, asking if the inner workings of the physicist constituted prima facie evidence that could be used to show the derangement of his son. That put the physicist in a bit of a quandary, as Frank recalled a bit later. The experts, especially the physicists, he said, were placed in a very difficult situation. Adler's father and family desired that this work should be made the basis for the opinion that Adler was mentally deranged. But this would necessarily be highly insulting to the author, since he believed he had accomplished an excellent scientific piece of work. Moreover, speaking objectively, there was nothing in any way abnormal about it, except perhaps that it was wrong. Meanwhile, Friedrich Adler had every intention of maintaining his sanity against his father, the courts, the right-wing screeds, and anyone challenging his epistemophysical work. He was willing to die for his sanity. So we have, in favor of judging Adler insane, the state prosecutor, the medical psychiatric panel, Trotsky with the internationalist left, and Friedrich Adler himself, in favoring of judging Adler insane, Victor Adler, the nationalistic press, and the social democratic press of the patriotic sort. Back to physics. With the return address Vienna 8 on 1 Alserstrasse, the prison, on 9 March 1917, Adler wrote to his relativistic twin, Einstein. Now that I have plenty of free time at my disposal, I have taken up my studies on the foundations of physics, which I had abandoned 7 years ago. I intended to assemble in a book my previously published and unpublished papers on Ernst Mach. The work had already progressed quite far when I started the chapter of relativity. Then something quite unexpected happened to me. Adler's philosophical work, Ernst Mach's Conquest of Mechanical Materialism, written in prison and published in 1918, had two goals. First, it was a rousing defense of many of Mach's doctrines, but it also reconstructed Mach, removing Mach from dogma. Like Mach, Adler wanted to free physics of absolutes in space, time, motion, and mass. It would be the counterpart, Adler argued, of Marx's historicization of the basic categories of an all-too-human society. Like Marx, Mach had grounded his views on experience, materialism, and made them irreducibly historical, equivalent, Adler said, to the dialectical. In fact, for Adler, Mach's historical materialism of the inner core of science was precisely the needed complement to Marx. To Einstein, Adler wrote that he'd taken Mach's view since 1903, that he, Adler, had taken Mach's view since 1903, and advocated the importance of the relativity of motion in his 1907 courses back in Zurich. He recalled for Einstein the arguments they'd had in the attic rooms of Moussonstrasse 12. I was very irritated, you see, that in taking the centrifugal effects into account, you rejected relativity for rotations. This is when Einstein was working on the special theory of relativity that has no place for rotations or other accelerated systems. So much the greater was my joy when your general theory of relativity came out a few months ago. Adler took Einstein to have accepted Mach's position entirely, including centrifugal phenomena. As Adler told Einstein in early February 1917, that joy was short-lived. I was in ecstasy when suddenly, 4 weeks ago, a turning point came in my considerations which reveals the whole problem in a completely different way than that which I'd seen previously. I found, first in a more recent discussion of Foucault's pendulum experiment, and then generally a criterion that you and Mach do not take into consideration, or at least not sufficiently, which sheds new light on it all. I believe I have found where the error in the assumptions, not only by Mach, but by you, lie. Adler's new system, he continued, does not involve a return to absolutes, but a criterion of a relativistic nature for preferred reference systems. Here, he hoped, was the true spirit of Machism rescued from Mach and Einstein's overextended development of relativity. There are three particularly interesting points about the technical criticism. First, Adler went after what he considered to be Einstein's and Mach's anthropocentrism, the idea that things came back too much to our human capacity and our perceptual senses. Second, on good Machist positivist grounds, he told Einstein that his own way did not involve the ether. No ether is intuitive, as Alfred Kleiner, their old thesis advisor, had advocated. No ether is a necessary physical hypothesis, as Lorentz believed, or even as pragmatically useful fiction, as Poincaré suggested. Nor was Adler interested on Machian anti-atomic grounds in the detailed structure or dynamics of the electron. That's what most physicists at this time are worried about, was how the electron might compress or form an oblate form as it moved through the ether. Lorentz, Abraham, Bucherer, and Poincaré were above all intrigued by the possibility of spelling out the electron's internal structure. That said, Adler's work does involve a privileged frame, but not because he believed the Earth, for example, is special. No, he argued that the privileged frame emerges from a rigorous application of the relativity principle itself. None of Adler's arguments moved Einstein particularly, but it forced Einstein to engage Adler in detail with as much care as he ever lavished on any critic over the whole of his career. Health-wise, I am fine, Adler assured Einstein, and since I have the opportunity rarely offered in life to be able to work in peace, I am completely happy, even though the time still available can only be counted by the week. The trial proceeded and ended dramatically. At the final judgment in May 1917, the court pronounced the defendant guilty and responsible. The punishment, according to Section 136 of the sentencing protocols, was to be death by hanging. 4 days after the verdict, Einstein conducted an interview in the Vossische Zeitung. It appeared in the morning edition of 23 May 1917. Friedrich Adler is physicist, a discussion with Albert Einstein. Undeterred, either by the sentence or the broader wartime repression that might have affected him, Einstein declared Friedrich Adler to be a clear thinker, someone who acted objectively and selflessly in his life as well as in his studies. Einstein related how years before Adler had sacrificed his own excellent chance to land the University of Zurich professorship, even though it was an existential necessity for Adler that he get it. Adler had removed himself in favor of someone else, whom Adler considered far superior from the point of view of pure science. Einstein neglected to mention that it was he, Einstein, who had been that competitor. Adler's work in physics, Einstein continued, consisted in the further development of the Machian point of view. According to Adler, in Einstein's telling, it was Mach who had brought it to consciousness that mechanics had not been essentially altered since the time of Newton. There had been formal adumbrations, to be sure, but it was in 1888 that Mach himself disentangled classical mechanics handed down from the time of Newton from an ideal mechanics that would be predicated only on the relationship of objects to one another with no relation to some external notion of space. Heinrich Hertz had developed this point of view further, and then through general relativity, according to Adler, Einstein had brought this ideal program to a more beautiful and more unified form that would overlap in everyday physics with the classical form. It was Adler's goal, so Einstein related, to describe the past of a body's behavior in terms of classical physics and to use this ideal physics, this new idea of just relating objects to objects, to tie a body to the rest of the world. The difference between classical mechanics and ideal mechanics consists in this. In ideal mechanics, there is only the direct description of a body's behavior relative to other bodies. No speed, no acceleration, no inertia, and no force could be used in reference to space in some abstracted sense. Adler, with Hertz and Einstein, the real path of the body is the straightest path. In classical mechanics, however, the real path is the superposition of two straightest paths, that is, the straightest path of velocity and that of acceleration. Despite Einstein's respectful description, he was clear. Adler's project was not his. In particular, Adler was determined to locate a preferred reference frame grounded in the center of gravity, for example, in the Earth-Sun system or the Earth-Moon system when dealing with terrestrial phenomena. In common with relativity theory, Adler recognized multiple equivalent and equally justified frames of reference. But Adler's point of view was necessarily narrower than general relativity, grounded as it was in the center of gravity of ponderable bodies. Einstein reported that Adler considered his description more natural and simpler. Einstein did not agree. Adler's execution was put off for various reasons, including influence of the party and the fear of the governing empire that they might lose the war and they would be blamed for attacking the socialists. And he was transferred to the fortress at the Stein on Danube, up here, upriver, literally, from here. This is the prison, which is still a maximal prison in Austria. The worst of the worst are there. And this is inside that prison. On the 6th of July, 1918, he wrote Einstein, "Dear friend, it has been almost 1 year since I wrote you, but I have been thinking of you incessantly, for I was occupied the whole time with relativity theory. I know that you are so convinced of the correctness of your foundations that you do not expect anything to come from further discussion, and yet I would like to burden you with the perusal of my book because I believe I've really found Ariadne's thread, leading to a complete and compelling derivation of the necessity for a preferred reference frame from your transformation equations. Simple diet, good air, quiet solitude, death row," he reported, agreed with him. "In virtually all respects, I am doing better here than in Vienna. In short, in this topsy-turvy world we now live in, it is an actual fact considerably nicer intramuros than extra." Adler's idea was this. He thought there were three different notions of time that needed to be taken into account. One was local time, Ortszeit, that was introduced by Lorentz as being a mathematical trick, a change of variables in the equations that would make them much easier to understand and make the equations formally look the same whether you were moving with respect to the ether that Lorentz thought was real and physical and had measurable properties, and then Poincaré, who was understood all the different proposed systems of electrodynamics. Poincaré never liked this idea of Lorentz. He loved Lorentz's contraction hypothesis, but he hated Lorentz's idea of this change of variables, this mathematical trick changing time to t minus vx over c squared. And so Poincaré realized, though, that there was another way of understanding this that made it physically real, in which you had, for instance, if I'm on a train going through the ether and I send a signal to the person in the front of the train, then it will meet the wind of the ether and be slowed down as it gets there. If you correct for that wind, it turns out to be approximately this idea of Ortszeit, this local time of Lorentz. And Poincaré thought that this now made Lorentz's hypothesis seem really plausible. Then there was the idea of zone time, which Adler modeled like the Eastern time that we use in North America, and dividing the world into zones that all share a time but differ from one another. And he saw this as sort of a regional coordination of time. And he thought that what Einstein's big mistake had been was not realizing that there was an intermediate level of generality where instead of assigning a different time to every observer, you would have a class of observers that would all share a time. And I'll explain that more in a moment. And then there was the idea of system time, which was a time as if you could have a time for the whole world or a single time that would function for every possible observer moving in every possible way. And that, Einstein had shown, was impossible. But according to Adler, Einstein had jumped too quickly from eliminating the system time to thinking that every single reference frame must have its own time. And I'll explain this more shortly. Adler thought that Einstein had done a lot of good things. And in many ways, he understood Einstein's relativity theory better than even some of the great physicists of the time. For instance, he understood very well that the coordination of clocks was the central feature of getting started in relativity, and that time was really the key to the whole problem. And then he said, Einstein's definition of synchronization is a major improvement on the clock coordination methods by defining a distant point's time in terms of a master clock and the time of reflection. So he understood exactly how this worked. He repeated it in the book. Then he said Einstein made many triumphs. He understood that you should put kinematics, force-free motion, before you try to understand the forces of electrodynamics. That was not understood by Poincaré or Lorentz, who didn't understand this aspect of what Einstein was doing. Adler liked Einstein's elimination of the ether, that many of the others did not like. Most everyone thought that this was a wrong-headed move by Einstein. Adler understood that Einstein had derived the Lorentz transformations. He did not assume them. Lorentz just assumed them and then saw what the consequences might be. And Adler grasped immediately the weight of Einstein's, that he knew, for instance, that you had to add velocities in a special and new way. If you had a flat car moving on another flat car, you had to figure out a new rule that Einstein could derive for how to see the velocity of the motion on top of the motion as seen from the ground. In fact, if you look at Adler's book, he has a chart that compares his system, Adler, Einstein, Lorentz, Poincaré, Fouquet, who is an ether theorist. And then I'm going to blow up the line about time. And you see there that everyone distinguishes between ether, or between a special system and other systems. Lorentz and Poincaré and Fouquet all have a T and a T prime, depending on whether you're in motion with respect to the ether or not. Adler distinguishes between these not because of the existence of the ether or not, but because there was a special frame of reference. And I'll show you what that is. And Einstein has nothing here. Einstein makes no distinction. Those dots are the sign that Adler understood, even though he rejected the singularity of Einstein's vision, namely that no frame has any privileged status over any other in terms of time. The conundrum that Einstein insisted on over and over again was that the famous experiment of Michelson and Morley showed that you couldn't see if you're moving in the ether, so it didn't seem as if the ether was that the Earth was moving through the ether that was fixed somewhere else. On the other hand, the Fizeau experiment, where you see if light can be dragged along by water, seemed to show that that you couldn't assume that the Earth was simply dragging the ether in such a way as to make us look like we weren't moving in it. So the ether could neither be still nor in motion, and that seemed to be the death toll for the ether. So Adler, though, there were other things that he detested about what Einstein has done, and one of them was his objection to what came to be known as the twin paradox. And on the 20th of September, 1918, he wrote him about that. But let me come back to that in a moment. Einstein filed a detailed response to Adler on the 4th of August, 19, that argued this way. At the root of all that Adler had done, according to Einstein, lay two crucial assumptions. A, that there was no Lorentz deformation of moving bodies as they moved by. If I move this laser pen by you, you see it as being shorter than one that's held at rest with respect to you. And no influence of the motion on the running rate of clocks. Assumption A, as Einstein noted, leads to the refuted notion that motion of an electron, and therefore was a direct problem in its confrontation with experiments. Assumption A also led inevitably to a direct contradiction with Michelson's experiment, if it is valid that for a preferred reference frame K, in which light travels the same speed always in all directions in a vacuum. Such considerations led Einstein to lay out for Adler precisely the constraints that he understood to hem in any putative theory of the electrodynamics of moving bodies. The two constraints being it has to satisfy both Michelson's experiment and the Fizeau experiment. And if it doesn't, it can't work. So the ether was neither in motion nor at rest. Einstein insisted it was these facts which compelled the formulation of the special theory of relativity. As far as Einstein could see, Adler had not even tried to address these constraining observations. The struggle continued. One of Adler's strong claims in his book was that the error of Einstein's consideration is hidden in the circumstance that Einstein has silently smuggled in the assumption that clocks in all systems have been coordinated. Einstein bridled. It is self-evident that I treat all times of the system in an equivalent way since I set out from the postulate of relativity. I cannot be reproached for not making use of your so-called zone time. Einstein insisted that Adler's symmetry system was simply an importation of the old Lorentz physics under a different name. Let me explain what that is, actually, and cut to the key of this, the key part here. So Adler, say, came up with this idea of a crucial experiment. He imagined that you had a meter stick, and the meter stick had contacts at both ends and were attached to a galvanometer, G. And one of these two identical meter sticks is wired like this, and the other one has a battery in it. So if they're still and you put them next to each other so that this contact meets this one and this one meets this one, then the galvanometer will deflect. Then he sets them in motion. And he says, suppose that I take this guy to be at rest and I move this one, say, from the right to the left. Then, as far as the still reference frame is concerned, this one shrinks and so no contact is made. So the galvanometer doesn't budge. On the other hand, if I take the point of view of the battery system and I move the bottom one, this is the same physical event, right? These are passing by one another. And he says, depending on which frame you work on, you can see it in different ways. One is to hold the galvanometer frame still and move the battery guy, and the other is to hold the battery guy still and let the galvanometer move. But then it's this one shrinks relative to this one, so still no current passes and the galvanometer is not deflected. But he said, if we move them at opposite speeds towards each other in a nice symmetric way, then however they shrink the same amount, and so the galvanometer deflects. Now, the galvanometer cannot both deflect and not deflect, so one of these must really happen and the other not. So he says to Einstein, bang, your theory's dead. And Einstein writes back and says, no, in fact, this is not, so he had this privileged reference frame, and you can divide the frames of the kinds of motion, the frames of reference, into pairs, right going and left going, V and minus V, you know, 2V and minus 2V, 27V and minus 27V. And that frame, in one frame of reference, there are these pairs of symmetrically moving frames of reference. Only within those does it make sense to talk about relativity. That's the zone time, the restricted class of frames relative to some symmetry frame, which he calls the symmetry frame K. Adler, relativity is smashed. The galvanometer will say that the two relativity theories, both Einstein and that of Lorentz, are wrong, and that neither of the two slabs is really contracted. Bang, Einstein's theory is dead. This time, Adler's target did not drop. Your bias, Einstein wrote to Adler, for absolute time or for the instantaneous signal, is exposing itself. Under no circumstances will a current flow if the contacts made are so brief that duration is small against the propagation time of light or of an electrical wave between the two contacts. Neglecting the necessity of keeping contact long enough for light to make the crossing is at the heart of the problem. But making the contact longer so this condition was fulfilled in the symmetry frame turns out to ensure that the galvanometer deflects in all the moving frames. Einstein liked the example of Adler so much, he wrote a new and related one for Adler that goes like this. Imagine that the blue frame is at rest and the red one is moving. Then you can put the red guy inside the blue guy. So it's shaped like this. You have this pipe that's bent like this. And so you move the red guy relative to the blue guy and then rotate him down. So he's now inside the wider blue one. On the other hand, if you take the point of view of the red guy, then the blue guy can be put inside the red guy. So you can't have that the red guy is inside the blue guy and the blue guy is inside the red guy in the same physical system. This, he said, is just like what you told me. And Einstein began to write it up. And in fact, Einstein began to design a dialogue about objections to the theory of relativity as a result of this, a kind of Galilean dialogue between the relativist and what he calls Criticus, the name of the critic of relativity. And the people, I think what's completely clear is that this dialogue, which Einstein published, submitted at the end of October 1918, on the 20th of October, is actually the sum total of his discussions with Adler in prison. Criticus is Adler. So, for example, under the pressure of Adler objecting to the twin paradox, Einstein works out for the first time a general relativity description of how to think about the twin paradox. How to describe the twin paradox, namely, if I and my twin are standing here and I go out and come back, or we separate and come back, you would think that how could my clock end up slower than his clock or be behind his clock? Supposedly, Einstein says in his first published paper on relativity, if I stand here and I send my twin to the moon and come back, he'll end up younger than me. but looked at from another frame of reference, namely if I follow my twin, I've gone out and come back. Well, how can, when I'm standing next to him, either one of us ends up younger than the other or vice versa? That doesn't make any sense. If my twin ends up younger than me or I end up younger than my twin, can't be both. So Einstein described this in general relativistic terms in his letter to Adler and then repeats it in this dialogue on relativity between the relativist and Criticus. So he says, okay, imagine you're in the blue frame, which is at rest, and you take the red clock goes out, is accelerated out to B, and then is accelerated back, and then accelerated to a stop next to me. So the blue clock says U2 is accelerated in a positive x direction by an external force until it reaches velocity V, continues to B, and then is accelerated back until it reaches V, coming the other way, minus V, and then is accelerated to a stop. K prime describes the situation, the red guy describes the situation in a different way. He says the red guy is held in place in a gravitational field with his retro rockets firing, use that term, rockets firing, holding him in place. And we let the blue frame, he says the blue frame just falls away till it gets to V. The gravitational field is switched off, it floats at V, and then is brought to a stop by a reverse gravitational field, and then falls back until the gravitational reverses, and then gently comes to a stop right next to me. So K prime says the gravitational field arises in the negative direction, U1 falls, and then falls back. Since he's falling, the blue frame doesn't feel anything. He's just in free fall, nice, smooth motion. But this leads to two different descriptions of what's happened. In the K says, the blue frame says that U2 is accelerated in the negative direction back until it gets and then stops. K prime says that a homogeneous G field arises in the plus direction until it reverses itself and it goes up to positive V and then it's turned off. So these are the two descriptions of what happens. In the blue prime frame, there's an artificial force that accelerates the clock, and he feels it. Red feels this force pushing him away and feels himself being driven to a stop. In the red prime frame, the blue one is just falling in a homogeneous gravitational field and then in a reversed one. That leads to two different two different things have happened. K says that the red guy lags because he's traveled out and in, and just calculate that with special relativity, if you want. But the red prime frame has a different explanation of what happens. U1 lags. In other words, he agrees. He says that U1 falls because of the velocity and coming back, but this is overcompensated by the fact that when the blue prime frame goes out, he's high in a gravitational field. And one of the things that Einstein had shown was that if you're high up in a gravitational potential, your clock travels faster. It goes faster. So there are two effects. As far as the red guy goes, the blue guy's clock is slowed down by the motion out and back, but it's sped up because it spent time high in a gravitational potential. So in fact, they both agree. The blue clock says that the red clock will be behind, and in the alternative explanation that's given by the red frame, he agrees with the conclusions of this, but gives it a different account. The red guy says that the blue guy also lost time by traveling fast, but gained time on his clock because he spent time high in a gravitational field. There is no paradox, Einstein concludes. Criticus, but isn't this gravitational field only fictitious? Its existence is, I should say, only stimulated by the choice of coordinates. After all, real gravitational fields are always generated by real masses and cannot be made to vanish. How could fictitious fields influence the rate of clocks? The relativist response, the distinction of real versus non-real is not very productive. With respect to K prime, the red frame, gravitation exists, just like any other object. No one doubts the existence of kinetic energy, even though it's frame-dependent. Better, inherent in a system versus independent of a system. Therefore, one can neither say that the gravitational field at a location is real, nor that it's fictitious. If there's a gravitational field in your frame, you say it's real, that's okay, just like you talk about kinetic energy. But if you're traveling with the object, then it has no kinetic energy. And similarly with the gravitational field, under certain circumstances, you can consider it to be fictitious. Relativist. But all stars in the universe can be thought of as taking part in the generation of the gravitational field because they are, during the accelerating phase of the coordinate system K prime, accelerated relative to the latter, and thus can induce a gravitational field. just as a moving charge can induce a magnetic field. If you move charge in a wire, it can make a magnetic field, and Einstein thought that gravity was, in effect, the inertial effects that we feel in the world are just the effect of the stars spinning, our motion relative to the stars. Criticus. Will someone make use of the possibility offered by relativity to relate the movement of the celestial bodies of our solar system to a geocentric system of coordinates? Could such a coordinate system really be considered at rest when relative to the fixed stars that race around the Earth at horrendous velocities? Wouldn't this be contrary to all common sense? And Einstein responds, there is no absolute movement. We have to use the equivalence principle. We have to have a physics that's local. And one of the real enemies of physics is this multiplication of different variations of a theory, and the postulate of relativity limited those possibilities. That in such a coordinate system, fixed stars would race around at tremendous velocities. In other words, if I spin around really fast, the stars are, in my spinning frame on the Lazy Susan, the stars are spinning like crazy. And Einstein says it may be inconvenient to use that frame of reference, but there's nothing wrong with it. It just might not be useful in making certain calculations, but there's nothing wrong with it. Relativity says there are many descriptions of the same situation. It doesn't guarantee that they'll all be equally useful for making calculations. Criticus, I see you have diffused my objection, but I must tell you your argument leaves me more convicted than really convinced. If anyone in Einstein's world was more convicted than convinced, it was Friedrich Adler in late October 1918. By then, the imperial armies were on the run. Einstein wrote to Adler on the 20th of October, wondering who between us will be the first to manage to come see the other. Who can know? Within days, the emperor was urgently pleading for assistance. The Social Democrats were hovering above the levers of power. Desperately, the old Council of Ministers offered amnesty for all political prisoners if they would only apologize. Adler, guess what, wouldn't. Friedrich Adler emerged from the Stein Fortress when, on 1 November 1918, the Habsburg family had fallen and was immediately greeted as a hero of the working class and not just in Austria. That said, it took extraordinarily little time after his release for Adler to clash with his father's moderate positions. It was the last of their battles. Victor died on the 10th of November 1918. Turbulent times, and both Adler and Einstein pushed for socialist internationalist positions, one that would eschew the anti-democratic drive of the Bolshevists. Einstein went to one of the soldier worker councils to plead for democracy, and on the 13th of November 19 pressed for a national assembly. Adler, too, was vocal in challenging the dictatorial left. Despite such increasing doctrinal tensions within the left, in January 19, Lenin and Trotsky offered Adler the position of honorary secretary to the Third International and honorary commander-in-chief status for the entirety of the Red Army, and honorary chairman of the Central Soviet. He refused. To Lenin's and Trotsky's dismay, Adler, at this point more famous than Einstein by far, did worse. He joined the center-left Second International as it met in Bern in February 1919, here, only to split with them because they purged the Bolshevists, and then more decisively in 1920. So he quit the Third International because he couldn't stand the anti-democratic nature of the Bolshevists, and then he quit the Second International because they fired the Bolshevists. In short order, he created the political version of his privileged frame of reference where he could follow no laws but his own. Vladimir Lenin returned the compliment. He denounced Adler in December of 1918. The bourgeoisie are compelled to be hypocritical and to describe as popular government democracy in general. The Scheidemanns and Kautskys, the Austerlitzes and Renners, and now to our regret with the help of Friedrich Adler, fall in line with this falsehood and hypocrisy. But Marxists and communists expose this hypocrisy as they aim to replace this with the dictatorship of the proletariat. Trotsky concurred, adding in April 1922 a postscript to his earlier and laudatory Novi Mir profile of the Adlers. Now he lamented that Fritz Adler's personal courage was not matched by his strength of thought. A fallen hero, Trotsky lamented, for now Adler acts as leader of the Second International, serving the cause against which he had attempted to stand up by staking his life. Political satirist, but also Trotsky, dubbed Adler's new position the Second and a Half International. With the help of the Moscow trial of 1-9, March 1931, aimed at sites at saboteurs supposedly encouraged by a scheming labor and socialist international, and expanded from the Second International, Adler and his allies blasted Stalin's falsehoods, showing with the cover photograph of the book that one of the accused, Abramovich, could not possibly have been in Moscow in August 1928 when he was supposed to be sabotaging things because he was in Brussels at the LSI meeting. Here's the here's Abramovich's. Here. Then Adler turned personal, and he also denounced Stalin and the witchcraft trials in Moscow, which was 1936. Then Adler turned personal. What I have so far set out could have been written by any other socialist. Though Adler never counted himself among the many, he said this, "I am compelled to speak personally, for my attitude to the problems raised by the Moscow trial is not so simple as that of those who reject individual terror on principle." He recalled his words to the Special Tribunal, in which he asserted that, in fact, every act of violence was justified against the rulers of Austria. Trials like his were a travesty of justice, he said, awakening in him a feel of offended honor, a feeling of shame at being an Austrian. Adler, every act of violence was justified against the rulers of Austria, but now terrorists should stay their hand against the Soviet Union. And to justify that, he said that there would certainly be a world war, a second one, that Nazi Germany was going to launch it in the next few years, and that Russia would remain the only bulwark against the Nazi takeover of the world. Unlike Trotsky or Lenin, the increasingly restive Second International, for that matter, Einstein, too, had already by 1930 sketched the Adlers in an elegiac light. Einstein had been, by then been had left ordinary physics fame behind. From the moment the pacifist physicist Arthur Eddington had announced the bending of starlight in 1919, November, Einstein was the subject of poems and polemics, architecture and arch enemies. In 1930, Emma Adler, Fritz's mother, wrote to Einstein, not, as she said, as the world-famous Einstein, but to the Einstein who years ago spent time with us in the Blumengasse, asking if he would contribute to a memory book of Victor. Einstein did, recalling their day together in 1911. In the older Victor, in the older Adler, Einstein saw a man whom every political camp trusted, a philanthropic spirit that grasped human frailties, a vestige of an older tolerant Vienna that no longer could be imagined in these times of desperation, a priest-like figure of a forgotten patriarchal past. Were such a man alive, Einstein ruminated, perhaps the powers at Versailles would not have conducted their tragic errors. No saint-like priest he, Friedrich Adler, never quit making trouble. He infuriated the communists by lambasting the Stalinist purges. He protested against the Popular Front. He rejoined the Second International, then blasted them for refusing to oppose Hitler during the opening salvos of World War II. During one of Adler's speeches, Leon Blum leaned over to his neighbor and whispered, "He shoots better than he talks." Fleeing to New York from Belgium in 1940, the Nazi capitulation found him in apartment 14C on West on 106th Street, just off Central Park West. "Dear friend," he wrote to Einstein on Mercer Street in Princeton in June 1945, "I was very happy to see you personally again." Not missing a beat, Adler plunged into a discussion of an American socialist and Max Born's latest on special relativity. The world changed utterly and not at all. Adler moved back to Zurich, working on a biography of his father. This is a monument to his father, and living until January 1960, and that's Fritz Adler in front. Friedrich Adler, I conclude now, Friedrich Adler is a troubling figure, an ever-recurring tertium quid, a third direction, in historical set pieces we are used to staging as two-part Manichaean struggles. He appears infuriatingly to stand for the right to the left and enragingly left to the right. He stood with clear-sighted sanity to some and obsessive insanity to others. The best, most efficient party official the Austrian socialists had ever had. A dutiful son, but also the schismatic, patricidal opponent of the ameliorist Austrian socialist establishment that his father had devoted his life to constructing. Fritz was a hero to the revolutionaries Lenin and Trotsky, nominated to the highest places, then rescuer to the Second International, then marching alone to the Second and a Half International's political night. From his cell came Ernst Mach's conquest of mechanical materialism. So he took Mach's anthropomorphism versus Planck's absolutism and found his own way forward in his book that he wrote in prison, in Sense-Based Abstraction. Then he took Einstein and Lorentz and wrote a second book in prison, still on death row, between relativism and the ether-privileged Lorentz, and found his idea of this zone system in which one had pairs of left and right moving frames. that in his form of Austro-Marxism, the Second International, a form of trade unionism versus the Third International, a universal proletarian dictatorship, and took them together and tried to form a second and a half international, which would say that there was room for play, so to speak, in which the superstructure of culture could function and science could be both part of the substructure, part of the basis for societal advance, but also free of that basis and able to construct more widely in an open-ended and cultural way. So in a sense, this third way that Adler developed, this recurrent third path that he spent his life pursuing, whether it was Einstein and Lorentz in physics, or Mach and Planck in philosophy, or the Third and Second International in politics, represented a constant attempt to break out of what he saw as the dichotomies that faced the 20th century as it opened in physics, in philosophy, and in politics. In many respects, Adler understood the special relativity, the theory of relativity, in ways that Einstein found completely lucid. The good prison air, as he reported, had left Adler not the slightest bit vague. For example, about several points in which he found Einstein's relativity theory to have substantially advanced physics. These were not trivial points. They had become points of contention among some of the most lucid commentators on physics of the last 100 years. Adler wrote lucidly in his book about Einstein's new kinematics, how Einstein had studied the properties of rulers and clocks before undertaking questions about the forces that move particles around. Many of the world's best physicists had not understood this about Einstein's work. Adler grasped, too, that Einstein had derived the Lorentz transformations, not assuming, as had Lorentz and Poincaré. And Adler noted very clearly that Einstein knew how to add one velocity to another relativistically. Adler, and practically no one else, saw immediately the importance of Einstein's velocity addition formula. Then Adler had wheeled around and attacked. Einstein's equations had hid a preferred reference frame. Adler is a kind of puzzle to us. And if he helps us understand better the choices that we've made so often at the beginning of the 20th century that have governed so much of what we think about politics and the world that was unfolding before us, then maybe that would be a good last shot from the would-be assassin of relativity. Thank you. You know, very rarely in the history of science do we have the possibility of looking at somebody who's sort of trained in the same place, comes from a very similar background, competed for the same job, was engaged in the same philosophical concerns, and then diverges in this way. So for me, Adler is a way of sort of throwing into relief in some ways the path that Einstein took and that was so formative. It's not because I think that Adler has a better solution to relativity theory, or because if we had only followed the second and a half international, we would live in a peaceable world these days. But rather that it just shows another way. It takes away from the sense of inevitability and of almost blindness to the things that they're given. And I think that from a political and philosophical and even scientific view, it shows in a way how remarkable the decisions that Einstein made were. It makes questions out of things that seem inevitable. And it's that throwing into relief that interests me most. And I do think that, you know, if I was looking for a sort of a political cultural resonance now, and, you know, I things are never the same 110 years after. I think, nonetheless, the dichotomous world that we're often handed in political terms, a world of black and white and all-out enemies, is a ferociously dangerous way of seeing the world, and that in that sense, I think it would be worth going back and thinking that everything is not so dichotomously given. And Adler, I think, spent his life trying to enforce that point. It's an incomplete analogy with the present, as history must be.
So we've become accustomed in history science to thinking that when someone's going to talk about politics and science, that they will discuss how one or the other has some causal relationship, or how the two have some or exist in some causal relationship. Instead, what you've done here at the end is to suggest that both Adler's science and his politics might have some common cause. And I wonder if you would then end up writing ultimately a kind of psychohistory of Friedrich Adler, I mean, if that's part of your project.
So I would say two things. First, the traditional way of handling Adler, Adler's physics has not been something that people have looked at, but Adler's assassination, of course, is well known. And the standard way of treating it has been psychohistorical, and partly because his father was a psychiatrist, partly because it came up at the trial itself, and so psychiatrists interested in history have often gone back and used this. In fact, you can find it as a case study in some ways. I think that's enormously dangerous for a variety of reasons, not because I don't think psychiatry can be an enormous and interesting light to cast onto aspects of history, but because the question of the psychogenesis of Adler's act was exactly what was at issue in the trial. And to write a historical explanation for Adler, what Adler did in terms of the inevitable outcome of insanity, is simply to take one side of that trial, namely the right-wing press and the father who was trying to rescue his son. And that seems to me, as a historical move, very dangerous to do, to simply promote one side in a trial to the meta-historical form of analysis. My own interest here is to say, it's as if you had suddenly found that there was somebody who was sort of grown up intellectually with Galileo and had been schooled with him and gone to had the same orientation in their relationship with religion and with their training in mechanics, and then had taken this orthogonal path. And that seems to me it's a kind of very interesting probe, and in fact shows some of the non-inevitability, that things can be contextual and yet leave, I think what's common to both Einstein and Adler is they both had this sense that they could change the world, that they could completely alter the structure of the way things were. And Einstein, in fact, ended up doing that in large extent, but not so much through his political engagement. He was very politically engaged all his life, up to the last days of his life in 1955. But through his physics. And Adler, had sacrificed his physics and decided that it was through politics. And he, in some ways, was enormously prescient. This was somebody who understood exactly where things were headed from the beginning of the First World War, that the idea of a socialist patriotism was going to end up playing into hands of the ultranationalists. He understood that World War II was inevitable. He understood exactly what the Nazis had in mind. He knew they were going to attack the Soviet Union. He wrote all these things down. He lobbied like crazy. And ultimately, his major engagement, the thing that he's remembered for, this assassination, did not change the course of 20th century political history. There is something common about these two people, exactly that they're the same age to within a few weeks, and they both thought that this was a world that they could alter. The world was opening up in ways that they could attack. And in a way, Adler's is a sort of the tragic alter ego to Einstein, somebody who threw himself completely into trying to effect these changes, trying to give Austria a pluralistic and democratic democracy. He lost essentially every political battle that he fought in reforming the socialist movement, in keeping the Nazis out of control in the 30s in stopping Nazi Germany before they got too far. Almost everything he tried to do ended up not working, but he threw himself into it with the totality that that both he and Einstein had shared from their younger years. So I think if there's a sort of a lesson from this, it's for sort of how to think about the history of science, it's that there's a tremendous amount we can learn through contextualization, but you also have to be cautious about it, and that to think of sort of the people engaged in these contexts as simply sort of, particles on a classical trajectory is not a very helpful way of understanding what happened either with Einstein or with Adler. And to understand the choices that were made in some ways is something that comes out of both comparing Adler to Einstein, but also in understanding the content of what Adler was doing, which was to try to argue that physics could both be at the foundations of a society, but also free from a totally determinist and outside force field.
Well, I think there are many more questions for you, Peter, but given the time, I think we should just thank Peter very much for this presentation, for making time. And before you go, just one quick announcement. Our next week's colloquium will not take place. So the next colloquium will be September 28th, and it'll be Stephen Morris of the University of Toronto Department of Physics.